we're about to learn about using TBRI to manage behaviors. Join us today on Fostering the Future.
Welcome to the Fostering the Future podcast, a show about all things child welfare, dependency, adoption, and foster care. Here are your hosts, veterans in the world of child welfare, Jack and Kat.
We believe that every human has incredible and equal value regardless of what side of the courtroom we sit on. We hope that everyone feels welcome and accepted here on Fostering the Future.
Make sure you follow us on Facebook or Instagram as Fostering the Future Podcast, or check us out on our website at fosteringthefuturepodcast.org.
This is Kat, and I'm here with Jack. And today we are talking with Leanne Drew, the Director of Child Welfare at Family Initiative, an organization in Florida that provides TBRI and other services to children and families. Thank you so much, Leanne, for taking the time to share your work with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I was really excited to take an online course on TBRI through your organization that was offered to foster parents, and I learned so much from it. I really wanted to share it with our listeners.
Leanne, we have a very serious question for you today. What is your favorite drink at Starbucks?
Today, I have a venti iced caramel macchiato with an extra shot, non-fat upside down.
So does upside down mean it's mixed?
They pre-mix it for you.
I have a friend who is not a big fan of Starbucks, but we're trying to convert her. And yesterday I spent much of the day with her and we started at Starbucks and she was very excited to try a caramel macchiato. Not calling her out, but she couldn't remember what it was called because it was like her friend told her to get that. So, but she kept saying macchiato. Leanne, I would like to ask you, who lives with you?
I have a husband and I have a 6-year-old daughter, and we actually recently got a corgi. She is just as sassy as my 6-year-old daughter.
So it's a good match for the family then.
I feel very teamed up against. I do. I ask myself repeatedly, why did I do this to myself?
So, like, the most important question is, what's her name?
Oh, Leia. Because we are a Star Wars family.
Star Wars or Star Trek? I always get them mixed up.
Stop! Oh, I'm so mad at you. No. You only do that to make me mad. Yeah. So my husband was a big Star Wars fan before I met him. And I kind of liked it. But now, like, you know, we're naming our kids after it. What was your first experience with the foster care system?
I think I was naive to it growing up and being little. Like, I remember HRS, you know, and people talking about it, and then DCF. But I don't think, like, my real, like, first experience with it where I acknowledged it was in undergrad. And I went to University of North Florida, and I interned at a Head Start in Fernandina Beach. And a lot of the kids there had some level of DCF involvement. And so working with the social worker there and kind of working through some of the issues on why DCF was involved, how we can stabilize families, was my first actual, like, experience with understanding the complexities of the foster care system. I honestly did not want to go to school for social work.
Listen, every single person who works here and somehow ends up in it has said the exact same. I did not want to do this. I specifically didn't want to do this.
Yeah, like, first it was teaching, and then I was like, okay, maybe I'll do, like, research psychology. I went back home after my undergrad program and met a mentor who navigated me to the world of a master's in social work. So that's how I ended up here.
And that kind of starts to answer the next question, is if you could give us a little bit of your history through just a general sense of, like, academics and where you started in your career to where you are now.
So my undergrad degree was at University of North Florida. I have a bachelor's in psychology, and I really didn't know what I was going to do with that. After I graduated from there, I went home for about a year. I did an unpaid internship at a skilled nursing facility. I found that I wanted to work with the aging population. It was going to be my bread and butter, right? Like, that's what I was going to do. I was interested in it. The research was great. Working with the families was awesome. When I applied to my MSW program, got accepted, that's where all of, like, my field internships were, hospices and Alzheimer's centers, caregiver support. But when I got accepted to graduate school, I also applied for a position. Didn't really understand what it was. Family support worker. Yeah, now I know what it is. So I applied for the position. I was in the interview and they're like, you know, you have the right degree to be what's called a case manager. Sure, why not? And so that's how I kind of got, that was my introduction into child welfare, was I didn't know what I was really applying for. Went in for the interview and they're like, hey, case management. I was like, sure, let's do that. But I fell in love with it. I really did. I did case management for several years down in Circuit 20. And then I did the family intensive treatment teams. I was the supervisor for that. I did licensing for a little bit. And then I kind of took a break after I graduated with my MSW. And I was looking to get licensed. I actually went into hospice and I started working in hospice.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. It was very powerful work. Yeah. And it gave me a lot of clinical skill set that I needed to have to come back into child welfare, like a big sense of empathy, which, I mean, I think you have that naturally when you come into this work.
Because it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
Very little reward.
Yeah.
It's got to be like coming from a place of passion and empathy.
Yeah. But I think that at 22, when I first became a case manager, I was almost naive to it. I just think that your eyes are big and you can go out there and you can change the world, which is all great mindset to have. But I think there are realistic things that you have to know and feel and be able to rationalize through and hold space for people. And at 22 and not really having that skill set. So coming back into child welfare after getting licensed and spending some time kind of on the completely opposite end of this work gave me a way better mindset to come back into it.
There are some really young caseworkers who come into it and I think they do want to change the world, but they don't have a lot of life experience.
Going in and being 22, I had relationships, but I wasn't married. I didn't have children. You know, my perspective, right? Hindsight is that I'm sitting in my office with people who have had really challenging experiences in their life. And I mean, there are people in my family that have had challenging experiences, but then I'm sitting across from them in my office and I'm telling them how to get their kids back. At the time, I don't think that I knew the heaviness of that moment for that person. And I think I took that for granted of like, well, I'm here. I have this degree. I got hired to do this. I went through 12 weeks of training. I passed a test. So I must know what I'm doing. And so I'm going to tell you, you know, what to do. I feel for new case managers. I really do. I do pre-service case management training. I go and I talk about our program and a little bit about TBRI. And I always try to tell them, like, I know what this feels like, right? I do. But just be mindful of the work that you're doing. Be aware. Stay attuned.
Something that we tell our kids a lot is the reason you can't make some of these decisions is because your frontal lobe isn't developed yet.
I tell my kids that
and
all the time.
It's so funny because most of these case managers are coming into my house with undeveloped frontal lobes.
Yeah.
And, you know, when kids get out of college, they have all this knowledge, right? They just don't know how to really apply it yet. They don't have the experience level. Put that together with an undeveloped frontal lobe.
Right.
And just like I'm telling my kids, you can't drive a car. You have me here to help you because I've got a frontal lobe. But what else do you do? You know, you got to get case managers from somewhere.
But it's like
and you got to start somewhere.
Yeah. The difference between being like a cog in the machine or being someone who can like truly anchor a family out of a bad situation. It reminds me also of like I had a loss in my life a few years ago. And one thing that I thought of a lot is every person I had worked with that had experienced death. Even if I gave them all the compassion, I didn't have the capacity to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So until I had experienced loss, I wasn't adequate.
Understanding your own history is what gets you to be the person that can show up for other people.
Now that we're here, can you describe for us what TBRI is?
TBRI is Trust-Based Relational Intervention. It is a modality that came from Texas Christian University at the Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development. Basically, what they did was they started holding summer camps for kids who had been adopted internationally from the foster care system. And a lot of the research came from those camps and how TBRI was developed. They would do parent training with the parents. They'd have the parents come in on the camp sometimes. But all of it was about what can we do to connect, right? What can we do to empower? And then how do we use that connection and empowerment to then correct the behaviors that these parents are seeing? And so it's very attachment focused and it's very like trauma based. And I think those are the two biggest things that when we're talking about foster care, that has to happen. We have to have an understanding of this child's attachment. We have to look at it through a lens of trauma.
That makes a ton of sense.
The whole modality was developed from kids who had been adopted. And a majority of our kids either find permanency, not with a bio parent. A lot of kids are adopted out of foster care. A lot of kids maybe have permanent guardianship with a relative or a non-relative. What TBRI does isn't necessarily like fix the kid. It's very caregiver focused, which is what I love about it. You have an understanding of that.
But that's true about almost all good therapy that works for kids, is it's really about, you know, you've got these foster parents who are like, this kid's a mess. Like, somebody's got to fix them. Actually, someone's got to fix you, teach you how to be the parent that that child needs so that you can help them become the person they need to become.
That's exactly what TBRI does. It empowers the parent, right, to understand this child and how to meet the need of this child. But it does it in a way that also makes you mindful of your own history and how you're showing up for that child, because that is 9 out of 10, right, of what's going to happen in that interaction between you and that kid, is how you actually show up to the party. Especially with the work that we do with kids in foster care, is they are so used to a certain pattern of behavior from a caregiver who may be unsafe or a caregiver who is struggling, right, and can't show up for them as the authentic person that they need to be because of mental health, substance use, whatever it is, their own trauma history. So a child isn't used to that type of pattern. So for a kid to come into a foster home or relative or non-relative home, that we have to understand that that pattern needs to change for them. And it's not going to be something that's easy for them, right? We're undoing, you know, either years, months, you know, a lifetime, whatever their lifetime is, of an inconsistent pattern of a caregiver. When people say things like, oh, well, I want the behavior to change, right? Like, I need this behavior to change. And so then my question to them is, what are you doing then? Right? Not the child, but how are you showing up? Are you matching that child's energy? Are you staying calm? Are you understanding and attuned to maybe why that child is upset? Or are you just looking at the behavior and not the need behind it? So there's just so many different aspects of TBRI that I feel are very important for caregivers, not just in foster, but caregivers, to understand about themselves when they're caregiving for a child, particularly a child with like a hard history.
I adopted my oldest child about almost 12 years ago internationally. So he was 2 years old at the time. He had lived in an orphanage. When a child lives in an orphanage, no matter what, there's going to be a pretty good deal of neglect just by the nature of, you know, being in a room with 20 babies and one woman doing what she can. I remember when I was preparing for the international adoption, and certainly when I came home from the international journey, Karen Purvis was the number one that everybody would direct you to. But I've sent so many people to the website back then, you know, over the years. It was kind of like, if there is a behavior that your child is exhibiting that you haven't figured out how to manage, go to this website. There will be a video somewhere on this website that shows you the best way that you can respond and help that child. I hate to say that we're working with behaviors. Where's the behavior coming from? Like, isn't a behavior just a symptom of something going on the inside that they're struggling with? While I'm saying we need to help this child with the behavior, what I really want is to help them with whatever is causing the behavior, whatever the thought process is, whatever the trauma that they are being triggered is. What I really want is for them to be a healthy physically and emotionally, you know, socially well-adjusted child to go out into the world. I just know that in the early years, whenever I was floundered at something, we would all just go to the Karen Purvis site. And I don't think we knew the term TBRI. I certainly knew the term connected child or connection parenting. I don't know if we just didn't know about TBRI or like technical modalities were developed later, but that was a very big part of getting through those tough times. And you're taking a child who has not lived in a family setting before, not even lived in this country. Like, basically, this could not be more literally foreign from them than they could possibly imagine. Everything about their environment and everything is changing. To try and expect them to have like appropriate behaviors is unrealistic. But when you see those behaviors, you could always go to this website and find ways to help yourself and learn about that. There's lots of different modalities of therapy and lots of different approaches to managing, quote, behaviors. A lot of people have talked about that ABA and TBRI are like alternatives. You could have TBRI or you could have ABA, but I've always heard about TBRI being focused on trauma versus like managing behaviors on a spectrum. Like, what is it for really?
TBRI is for caregivers, right? And so it teaches the caregiver how to respond to that particular child. So whether a child has trauma or whether a child is neurodivergent, TBRI, in my opinion, can be a modality that you use. So my daughter, right, just kind of personally, she's neurotypical. She's 6. I didn't become a TBRI practitioner until she was 3. So the parent that she had from birth to 3 was extremely different than the parent she has from 3 to 6. And it'll be different from the parent that she'll have moving forward for the rest of her life. And that is because TBRI has kind of opened my own lens, right? And so Karen Purvis says, you can't parent if you're parenting through the lens of your own history, right? You can't meet your child's needs if you're doing it through the lens of your own history. And so part of the journey for me was understanding that with my child, my triggers, right? And so same thing with a kid on the spectrum, kid with ADHD, whatever the diagnosis is that the doctor wants to give.
Yeah.
Until I understand myself and my own history and my triggers, I can't actually fully show up to understand what that behavior is. And the behavior is the communication of an unmet need, right? And so there's a need behind that behavior. So I'm not actually trying to focus on the behavior in front of me. I'm trying to be detective to understand what is the need behind it. And if I'm triggered and I'm escalated, I can't do that. And so I think that TBRI can be used across, I mean, anywhere, right? And schools, churches use it, like daycares. I mean, really anywhere, I think TBRI can be applied.
So circle of security, the type of training that that gives a parent kind of feeds into a lot of what you're talking about. I think there's probably a lot of crossover. I always recommend circle of security training to everybody, whether you're a foster parent or whatever, very much about recognizing your own triggers and your own history. For me personally, like, I don't have a history of like crazy trauma or anything, but there were things that they did that weren't necessarily wrong that now that I've taken circle of security, realized that I was repeating things that they did that weren't helping my kids. That was huge for me. The one biggest thing that really changed my parenting was, I guess I'm uncomfortable with my kids being upset and crying. So when they're hurt, when they're upset, my response is always, oh, don't cry, you're fine. I thought that's just what you say to kids. It's not. You are dismissing their feelings and also creating a false sense of reality. Like, if you fall, you're supposed to hurt and cry. And if you don't respond in that way, that is not a healthy emotional response.
It brings me to the Maya Angelou quote, right? When you know better, you do better.
Yeah.
Right. And so until you know, you can't do. And you also can't give what you don't have.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's the other piece, I think, about if you have one child who had a completely different parent than your children now. We have caregivers like this. A lot of foster parents with like older bio children. The kids are like, why are you doing that? Like, that doesn't make any, you never did that. Like, I would have been grounded and everything would have been taken away. Yeah, like, I wouldn't have come out of my room for like a year, you know, like all of the things. And then they see you kind of getting down on the kid and getting on eye level and like healthy touch and tell me what you need. And they're like, what is this? I always have conversations with those older kids that you can still have that relationship with them too, right? So like you can reverse that with the older kids as well. But I tell them like, you know, your parent is doing what they need to do for this kid in this moment. And they may have messed up before, but there's still time to repair that. Still, I think your point to like, you probably still make mistakes. I think everybody makes mistakes. I mean, I am 100% not a perfect parent. None of the practitioners on our team are perfect parents. We all come to each other and say, I really messed up today. But it's all about coming back and holding yourself accountable for that and that rupture and repair and that attachment with you and your kid.
You know, my mom was like really, really good at that. Of course, all of our relationships are, you know, have a lot of factors, but everybody loves my mom. Like everybody. She's like very gregarious and very kind. And I remember being like 12 years old and my sister is like 7.5 years younger. I might have been like 10. And she bought my sister a dollhouse and I had no reaction. Like I didn't care. She came up to me and said, I bought her this dollhouse because I always wanted to buy you a dollhouse and I wasn't able to. I didn't even remember not having a dollhouse. Like I had moved on. I was like playing volleyball. I must have been like 12. Like I didn't play with toys anymore. I remember thinking it was just so nice.
It was very thoughtful.
It was so thoughtful. I mean, I had like baby dolls, Barbies galore. I had like everything that I personally wanted. I'm sure I would have loved a dollhouse. But my mom like reached out and was like, I really wanted you to have a dollhouse and I wasn't able to get you one, which is why I wanted to get your sister one so badly. And I was able to get her.
You know, the cool thing about that is not just that she was thoughtful enough to think of it, but that she was brave enough to say it to you. What really takes bravery is for you to go to them and say, listen, like I messed up and I'm sorry. And, you know,
this was like, probably like 1990 when parents weren't nice to their kids, you know? Like I've always remembered that. She treated me like a human with like respect and kindness.
I think that's what kids want, right? They want to be seen, right? And they want to be heard and they want to be valued. And I think that we do that not everybody, but a majority of, you know, the population has a secure attachment. And so we tend to do that with one another. We make each other feel seen, heard, and valued. But for some reason, we view kids as to be seen and not heard. Right. And it doesn't matter about their history. This could be, you know, trauma, no trauma. You were to comply the first time. Mm-hmm. I need you to just, you know, do what I say. And they're human, right? They have questions. They have curiosities. And I don't think that that's always bad, right? I think there's a time and a place. And I think that there is a definite balance between structure and nurture and how that child comes to you with those questions. But you want that from your kids, right? You kind of want that fire and that passion. Mm-hmm. And for them to feel like they can go into the world and speak their mind in a positive way. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of this modality working for a range of kids, for someone who does have a kid with behaviors that might be seeking ABA services, can you talk about the differences between TBRI and ABA?
Well, so our company has a foundation in ABA. We started working with children on the autism spectrum in our initial programs. Our agency has a very strong foundation in ABA, right? Because that's where we started. I think for our agency, what we have done with TBRI and ABA is just trying to understand how they can work together. But it's just trying to know that not one thing is going to work for one kid. And what is it that their child is needing, right, from a therapist or from a modality? And is that therapist willing to listen to you and what you think that your child needs? Because that's what's important. You need to be seen, heard, and valued. Your child needs to be seen, heard, and valued. What is it that you need as a parent? What is it that the child needs, right? What are your goals for your child? And maybe what are your child's goals, right? If they're able to tell you, right, what it is that they need, let's listen to them a little bit as well. And looking at a child as a unique individual and not a cookie cutter system.
For most people who would be looking at both of these, reaching out to family initiatives might be a great way to go because you guys have experience in both. When you do TBRI, you're probably also bringing in an ABA mindset too.
Well, I would think that you have to because in my like work as a therapist with children and parents, one parent in particular that was away for her child for a long time during COVID. Mm. And that child was on the autism spectrum and had ABA. A lot of times their goals and our goals were at conflict. What they were asking this mother to do, it did not align with creating a secure attachment. And so I would imagine that, you know, if a child was receiving ABA and TBRI, that there would have to be some creative measures taken because I'm sure that some kids do definitely need ABA and TBRI. Like, for instance, we were doing lots of peekaboo and I'm going to get you and those kinds of things. And they were trying to get the mom to like never let him run. That's valid, not eloping. Unfortunately, we were not able to like compromise. We just had to do therapy on different days and mom couldn't be involved in ABA therapy at that time. But I would imagine that compromise definitely could be made in the right situation.
And I think attachment goes back to everything. And I think I may have said this before, but whether the child's neurodivergent, trauma history or not, there is something to say about how us as caregivers showed up for that child in that first year of life and how that attachment cycle was patterned for them, right? If I cry and you come and you do that consistently and you do it with comfort and delight, then I know that you're my person. And so that child then develops a secure attachment. And whether that child is neurodivergent or not, or has a trauma history or not, they know that this person is the person that they're going to go to when they feel unsafe, when they are hurt, when they need a hug. And it's not that you're just going to meet my instrumental needs. You're going to give me that nurturing care that I also need.
Well, and that is something that I have struggled with. And I don't know if this is all ABA, but my experience with ABA with my child who is neurodivergent is that when he is unable to regulate, what I have always done for him is I scoop him up and I hold him and I pat him on the back in this one little spot that I've been doing since he was 10 days old and he slowly calms down. But with ABA, I was told to not give him that comfort because then I'm rewarding bad behavior. And that when he is either having behavior or unable to regulate himself, I'm supposed to face him away from me and just hold him like almost in a hold. I didn't do that. I was not following through on that because it did not feel safe. If he's not able to regulate himself, like that's what I'm there for, right? when I tried to do their version, it made every behavior bigger and longer. And there wasn't comfort and there wasn't like an eventual relaxation in his body. It just intensified until he threw up. And I don't know if that's really what he needs. And I'm fighting, you know, the battle. I feel like when he can't regulate himself, he's scared. And I want to provide comfort and security to him. And to do the opposite did not feel natural as a parent.
I don't know. I've been telling my kids lately, like, your job in relationships is to be a safe person, you know, because I feel like that's like the bottom line. We can make all these rules about like, don't do this, do this, don't be a bully, report. Bottom line, you need to be a safe friend. Bottom line, if your friend isn't safe, back away. Bottom line, if your teacher doesn't seem safe, tell someone. Bottom line, relationships have to be safe.
And I think that from what you said, though, it didn't align with you. I can't speak to, you know, this therapist or this agency. And that's kind of why, you know, I always tell parents, like, you have to find a place that you feel is hearing you and hearing what you and your child need, whether that's traditional ABA, whether that's TBRI, whatever other modality that's out there for you and your kid. You have to feel confident in that.
So basically, the main core difference between TBRI and ABA would be the focus on the attachment, the focus on the attachment and the relationship and in providing comfort and delight.
So
I
love sweet.
That. Yeah, I can't take a credit for that. That came from Scott Waters. He's a practitioner. For me, what TBRI sets apart from really a lot of other modalities is the fact that the caregiver has to really reset that attachment for that child. Like, you have to be that one safe, caring, loving adult that's going to be consistent for that kiddo. And I know there's other modalities that probably say that, right? But connection is the heartbeat of TBRI. And if you don't have connection, you're not going to have correction, right? And so, like, the three principles, connecting, empowering, and correcting, like, if you can't get connected to your kid, if you are not there, then nothing else is really going to kind of move forward, right? Because they don't trust.
For years, people would ask me about, you know, maybe a certain kid that they were struggling with that came in and had all these behaviors. And what I always say right off the bat is that kid does not give a crap about your rules until they give a crap about you.
Right.
And if you don't have a connection with them, one of the things I always do with the older kids, usually in the first day or two when they come to my house, is I take them to Starbucks and we go and we sit down inside and get them whatever they want. Like, you want to big ass frappuccino, like whatever it was, you know, cake pop, brownie, like just give them whatever they want so that they're kind of a little more relaxed, I think. Not that like the fact that you were just torn away from everything that you care and love about isn't like overweighing everything, but it could kind of like snap you out of a hard mindset for a couple moments, maybe. I usually just like have like super random, like, oh, what music do you like? You know, should we go get you some new sneakers? That kind of thing. That is what I feel like has always led to this great journey of relationship with kids of that age, because they want someone to listen to them and ask them questions about themselves. You know, it's different at different ages, right? So a younger kid is going to be a different, like, here's a cake pop. Let's, you know, what's your favorite color? What do you like to watch on TV? You know, you could look for ways to kind of build that relationship when you try and find some like common interests or something like that. So just on a simpler level, it's like nobody's going to care about your stupid rules or following them when they don't even know you or care about you.
Like, when a kid enters foster care, it's like an adult going to a foreign country and being dropped there with none of your belongings and not speaking the language. When you have that happen to you, what's the first thing that you're going to try to do? You're going to try to survive that situation because it's just as scary as the situation you came from. It's still just as unpredictable. And until you have community and connection where you are, you can't actually have felt safety. The state can come in and tell a child, well, this person's safe because we did a home study and background screens on them. That means nothing to them because internally they don't feel safe.
In the situations where they thought they were safe before, they weren't safe. And the one person in the world that they were supposed to trust, maybe in some way, has broken that trust. So why would they trust some random stranger that someone dropped them with who, you know, might look a little funny or, you know, their house might smell a little different? Is age a factor in the success of TBRI? And if so, which ages usually have the best success?
I love this question. Because when you take the training, you'll see a lot of videos in the training, right? And everybody's like, oh, this is all for little kids. But TBRI actually was developed around teenagers.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's a whole like TBRI for teens, like video and like training stuff. And so it really can be used for any age range. I think why people feel like it's not for teenagers is because you're undoing years and years of trauma. So that connection may not be happening as fast. They're going to be more resistant. Technology has a huge factor in this because they can still connect to unhealthy patterns of relationships, which can impair their ability to then connect with somebody who is trying to kind of pull that out of them. Younger kids, even though it might be a very severe traumatic experience, it might have not been as prolonged as some of the teens. So it's just harder, right? I think kids are, you know, naturally just want to kind of like love somebody, where teens are like, I got this. I've got this for myself and I've done it for years.
So 100%. That is so true.
Right. And for me as like a clinician going into the home and teaching caregivers on how to do this, I say, okay, respect that. Respect the fact that they're telling you to back up. Respect the fact that they don't want to give you eye contact. Respect the fact that they're not going to like do your 10 rules, right, that are on there. Until you make the opportunity for them to come to you for connection, then this is how this power struggle is going to continue. And so you got to lower the bar and you got to have them come to you. Eventually they will. Eventually there'll be a need that they know that you can fulfill, whether it's I need more money for Robux or whatever it is these kids these days are doing, or I need some more Starbucks gift cards. Eventually they're going to come to you and that's your connecting moment. That's your in, right? That's your shared interest. I am terrible at video games. I am awful. Ask my husband. He tries to get me to play with him all the time. Awful. But if I know a teen or a youth likes them, I'll go into a home and I'll play. They might beat me and they might tell me that I'm horrible and not say very kind things. But I'll be like, yeah, I know I am. But it's finding that common interest. And I think so much of what adults want to do is to kind of have that child come into their family and just kind of mold in.
Right.
Right. And but you have to mold around that kiddo.
So do you think you see more success, though, in the younger kids just because they don't have the years that you're undoing? Or do you feel like you have the same amount of success? It might just take longer.
We see probably more success with the younger kids because they can stay and stabilize placements longer. The goal of our program is placement stabilization. But when we get kids who are placed that have had, you know, they're in their 30th, 40th, 50th placement, and they're, you know, chronic runaways, I think that it's very challenging to keep them in one place with one caregiver long enough for them to kind of repattern their attachment.
How can TBRI work for children who have attachment disorders like RAD?
Obviously, it's in the DSM, and obviously, it is a clinical diagnosis.
I thought it wasn't in the DSM anymore, but somebody told me recently that their kid was diagnosed with RAD, and I was like, well, maybe it's back, or maybe it never left. I don't know.
When it comes to attachment disorders like RAD, yes, I do think that TBRI can be beneficial. I also think that there are other things that need to happen within that family dynamic, right? So I think everybody probably needs their own mental health counseling. There might need to be some family therapy mixed in there. But I think if a caregiver can understand that what the child is doing is not about that caregiver, then it can help with their ability to keep showing up for that kid and not for that parent to develop what is now being kind of coined blocked care. Kind of like the inability to connect with your own child or, you know, because of the fact that they are not connecting with you. I'm hearing this a lot in the adoptive community lately. And for me, I just repatterned that caregiver's attachment with TBRI, right? I kind of look at the way that they have built relationship with this child and then I approach them, right? And that like meeting their need, right? Consistently. The biggest thing is that none of the kids' behavior is really about that caregiver. And TBRI teaches you that, right? That behavior is the communication of an unmet need. So if that child does have an attachment disorder, TBRI is an attachment-based program, right? And so the whole point is to repattern that attachment.
It makes me curious, too, about like kids who have parents with disabilities or kids who are parentified, you know?
Honestly, I feel like TBRI can be used everywhere. The connecting and empowering, like connecting is all like the attachment and the engagement strategies, right? How do you actually like present yourself to the child in those hard moments? And are you being mindful? Empowering strategies, understanding how the child's sensory system is working or what their physiological needs are, all lead to correcting, right? Which is, you know, basically being able to modify that behavior and meet that child's need.
Is TBRI a solution for kids who don't have behaviors that they should?
The caregiver models regulation. They're the external regulator and then the co-regulator, and then the child learns how to regulate themselves. That's the whole goal. So I think even in emotion identification, like if you model excitement, I don't see why a child couldn't pick up on that pattern either. There's this thing called mirror neurons. You have an infant in front of you and the parent is making like happy, giggly faces, right? And then the parent turns around and then comes back to the child with a stoic face. And the child is then like, you know, trying to be happy and silly like you just were, but the parent stays stoic. And then all of a sudden the baby backs up, starts crying or whatever. And then, you know, the parent comforts and then comes back, right? And so the child, it's like that mirror neuron, like they want to mirror all of that stuff. And when you don't mirror it back to them, they're like, oh no. I think of the brain as like a muscle. And the more you like have somebody practice doing something, you know, the way that you want it done, then they're going to build the muscle memory to do that thing. Right. And so if you're constantly smiling at them and then they're mirroring it back to you, then you're just rewiring the brain to do that.
How can TBRI work for kids who have prenatal drug exposure?
Again, I think that we have to take the sensitivity to that they're going to be neurodivergent, right? Whether they get diagnosed with FASD or sensory processing or ASD, we do have to take into consideration that their brains are working differently, and TBRI does that. And so in TBRI, they talk a lot about the chronological age versus the social emotional age. And so a lot of times when you're working with kids, they might be, you know, 14 in front of you, but their social emotional age is 7. So it's like half of that chronological age. And so if you can understand that about kids, even with in utero drug exposure, then you're going to be successful because your expectation of them is not going to be unattainable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the issue a lot of times, especially with teenagers, and why this also kind of feels like it only works with younger kids, is that we can explain a 6-year-old having a tantrum, but you can't explain like a 12-year-old having a tantrum like a 6-year-old. But you really can if you understand that early substance exposure, probably traumatic pregnancy, you know, any type of history that they've had since then, didn't allow their brain to develop at the same pace as somebody who comes from a secure home.
Is there anybody that TBRI does not work for?
No, I mean, I do it to my mom. She probably doesn't think that I do it to her. Sorry, Mom. But I have been trying to actually have more compassion and empathy and understanding in that relationship. And so I think that even in adult relationships, this can happen, right? And it can heal adult relationships.
I've taken Circle of Security like 7 times now. I try to take it once a year. I get more out of it every time I take it.
I feel that way with TBRI. And I feel that way when I see different people train it.
Yes. The thing with Circle of Security is that people interact. Mm-hmm. So every time you go, it's like a different experience. Yeah. But I started doing that in all of my relationships. And the funny thing is that Jack Daddy would be like, are you Circle of Securitying me? Like, I know where you're getting this from, especially after you took the class. So yeah. that was kind of funny.
My husband always tells me, don't social work me.
Can you tell us a story about a time where you saw TBRI achieve success in behavior improvement and overall well-being for a particular family?
I have seen successful adoptions with a teenager. So one of the very first teenagers that I worked with coming into this organization, into the role that I am now, she was 15 at the time, and she was supposed to be placed with a caregiver out of state. Caregiver was dragging their feet, not doing the ICPC home study stuff. Every time there's a continuance. And eventually that caregiver just kind of stopped communicating. And it was a hard blow for that teen. She was unaware, but the foster mom that she had been with was willing to adopt her, but never had that conversation with her because did not want to kind of skew her decision to go be with family. So when we were working with them, the typical complaints of a parent, she's not cleaning her room, you know, she doesn't come home on time for curfew. And so we talked a lot about caregiving style. Are we allowing her to have a voice? Are we giving her choices? Are we accepting some of her compromises? And as the foster mom was more willing to communicate and not be like, just do as I say when I say it, you kind of saw that relationship flourish. And this was happening at the same time that this ICPC was kind of breaking down. When that finally came about, the caregiver had the conversation with that youth. Now, I mean, they still have issues with keeping the room clean. And I mean, there's still all that. But the adoption was finalized, right? And the youth had a stable placement. This is the first stable placement that she's had since she was a young child. I mean, her dad was murdered. Her, you know, mom had overdosed. She was living with a relative for a long time who was an alcoholic and met her instrumental needs. But there was really no nurturing care there. There was no emotional attachment. I mean, I think they still struggle with that, right? Like their attachment because of her history. But it's something now that the caregiver understands more about and doesn't take it so personally. I understand where that's coming from in you. These are my expectations. And that's the thing that I like about TBRI, because it does balance structure and nurture. Like, don't forget, I'm still the boss, right? But I'm willing to hear you out. but I have the final say. And I think that was what that youth needed, right? As somebody who says, I hear you, but I'm still going to come to you with some structure. So that was an adoption story. I mean, I've seen it work through reunification too. If you have a successful co-parenting relationship between a foster parent and a bio parent, and everybody's speaking the language of TBRI, that child is going to be so much more successful going home. But in order for that to happen, right, the foster parent and the bio parent have to kind of be speaking that same language. The best way is not for me to go in with the bio parent and teach them. It's the foster parent to go in and teach them what they've learned about TBRI, what has worked for that youth to kind of repair that rupture and that attachment relationship with that bio parent. And so to me, that has been the most successful cases that I've seen.
I really love that idea of the foster parent and the parent to work together to kind of use TBRI to nurture those relationships and help the child have overall healthy well-being. Can you share a quick tip or some type of instruction for our listeners for something they can do with their foster children that will help improve connection and decrease behaviors?
So I think I'm going to lean heavily into the engagement strategies and the connecting principle. So eye contact, healthy touch, mirroring, tone of voice when we are approaching our kids in whatever situation, but mainly in a situation where a correction has to happen, how we do it is so important. Because we can either have a fear-based response of compliance, or we can have a corrected behavior that comes from a connected place. One of the things I would tell parents is not to demand eye contact. I think so many of us come from a history ourselves in parenting, you know, when we were parenting, where eye contact is, that means respect. Our kids might not be able to give us eye contact, and if they can, it might be fleeting. To me, eye contact is necessary when your face, right, and your body can tell that child that they are precious, that everything about them is perfect and precious and that you love them, not as a source of, I'm going to give you the look and you know what you got to do, right? Because that's a fear-based response versus a connected response. So if you go up to a kid and you ask them for eye contact and they can give it to you, fantastic. If you give them like a little brush on the cheek to kind of bring them back to you just so that you know that they're still with you, fantastic. But to hold a child in eye contact, to me, only exacerbates that fear-based response. Because one, we don't know if that was something that they were demanded to do in those times where they were feeling, you know, scared. But it is a demand that not a lot of our kids can meet, but a lot of things that we expect. So that's one, no demanding eye contact, except the fact that they can't give it to you. But if you need to, right, like again, gentle touch to the face, come back to me, ask them for a brief moment of eye contact. Did you hear what I said? Great. But only if your face is indicating that they are precious.
So that was like the best answer.
And the other thing is healthy touch. So I think tactile sense is one of the very first senses that's developed in utero and is fully developed once a baby is born. And so when you pick up a baby, right, you're not rough. A lot of times it's nice, soft, healthy touch, right? And so we have to understand that maybe some of our kids that come to us either have been sexually abused or physically abused. The safe, healthy touch that we know might not be safe and healthy for them. And so asking them, do you like high fives? Do you like hugs? Right? Do you like fist bumps? Do you like to sit next to me on the couch? Do you want me to sit on a completely different couch? Right? It's again, being a detective and trying to understand what their need is. And if that means that you can give them hugs every time they come home from school, then do that. But maybe what you have to do is give them a fist bump first and work your way up to a high five and then work your way up to like maybe a little side hug and then a full embrace, right?
Yeah.
But just having that understanding that if we allow the child to have voice on what it is that they like, right, we're giving them autonomy, right? And that is one of the four characteristics of secure attachment is to be autonomous. And so, and we're also giving them the ability to give and receive care, which are two other characteristics, right? If you want a hug, you can give me a hug. If I want a hug, I can ask you, right? And you can receive it. Or you can say, no, I think I'm just comfortable with a high five today. Fantastic.
If you could change one thing about foster care, what would it be?
Wow. CPIs, for example. Like, I'd love to see them have a little bit more support.
I would love to see them get a little TBRI training.
If the one thing I could change about the system of care in Florida is that there is a revamp with TBRI being a part of it. Which I think Florida is kind of bringing TBRI into the system of care. We had a practitioner training here this past year. Lots of people from, you know, child welfare were there. But you're right. I do think that TBRI can change the system of care. And it has changed the system of care in Texas. Like, they've actually utilized this in one of their court systems there. There's a documentary on it. And it changed the whole way that this happened. They've integrated into DJJ systems there, the dependency systems there, group homes there. So because it was created in Texas, it definitely has been utilized in Texas in a lot of different varieties. Yes, I think that TBRI being implemented throughout the system of care in Florida would be a fantastic change. For me, when I was in case management, if I would have known about TBRI and really just kind of like the neuroscience of it and the attachment piece of it, I may have handled things differently than I did. And again, hindsight, but I think I could have maybe reunified maybe more families if I had this mindset. But I also think another thing that can change in child welfare, and I know that there's lots of things around this, the person who's caring for the child in out-of-home care, like the support that they need to do that needs to strengthen, but then also the support for the bio parent to kind of build the bridge between the two. Because if the goal is to have safe children in their families of origin, then that's what we need. The components of the system have to focus on those two things, keeping the kids safe while they're in out-of-home care, right, and supporting that, but then also understanding that the services that we're giving that bio parent need to also do the same thing.
I'm like very pro problem solving programs versus, you know, whether it's in the court systems or in case management agencies or what have you, the approach that so much traditional dependency takes is like a punitive. You did this wrong. These are the things you have to do if you want your kids back, without looking at the family as a whole and what their history is and why we ended up here. Not that we ended up here, this is what you have to do to get out of it. Instead of that punitive checklist, like, where are we going to make you jump to get your kid back? What are the problems? Like, what are the reasons we got here? And how do we go back there and heal them? Because a punitive system, if you get that kid home, which often does not happen, they're going home to the same home they left. And maybe it's a slightly better situation, but it's bound to return to the previous problems if you're not fixing the source of the problem, right?
Yeah, because we all operate in a reactive state almost all the time, and definitely these families are. And then the court system and the case management, it's all reactive. It's all, you did this, so now you have to do this. Even if they're able to start to be proactive and jump through these hoops and get a psych eval and go to parenting and somehow like rise above their current situation, they're going to go right back. So often they do. I'm not saying they always do, because
But if you're not fixing the actual problem, they're going to start bleeding again.
Right.
You know, you can't put a Band-Aid over a freaking hernia. It's just going to keep bleeding, and you're going to have to keep changing the Band-Aid.
It's like walking around on a broken leg that needs surgery and expecting people to run these marathons to get their kids back. Like, we need to be giving everybody like trauma therapy, if not only for like the trauma of having their kids removed,
but the inevitable trauma that they experienced that got them to that place.
Right. Well, it's the definition of insanity, right? Like doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
All the parents I've interviewed for CBHA's, the trauma. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of them would be like, no, I had no trauma.
And then
you
find the trauma.
And then we start talking, and like the things that they told me about, like sometimes I'm like, I don't even know how you've been able to go on.
Well, and the fact that they don't find it traumatic. Right. And so that goes into a whole nother part of like the neuroscience of, you know, their history and how that has changed their brain.
Right.
Right. So that they don't even feel like they are in danger because their body has always been in this constant state of hypervigilance, and they don't realize that their experience is trauma. They realize that that's just another day, because maybe my mom went through that and that was modeled for me. And then her mom went through that and that was modeled for her. And so they don't even realize that what they have been through is traumatic. They just think that's another day.
I'm trying to create a connection with parents and make sure that they know that I'm not here to judge them, and that I'm understanding that there was probably something that got them to this place.
Well, not to interrupt, but I think you've been really good at being a safe person for almost all of your bio parents. They haven't always reacted well to you, but I'd say a lot of them have. Like, you go in and you're like, I'm not trying to adopt your kid. And I think that is really good at like eliminating the.
I know that I've had a lot of conversations with parents on the front side where I've made it clear that I'm not judging, and that I understand that like none of us get to a place like this without having some experiences in our life that put us there. And I've had a lot of parents who've told me off the bat, oh, I had a great childhood. Like, I've never had anything happen to me. And then they get through their classes and they start doing more therapy, and they say something to you about being sexually assaulted as a child. And you're like, well, gosh, I thought you said you didn't have trauma. Oh, well, that's happened to everybody in my family. You know, it's not that big of a deal. I don't think about it all the time. Well, that doesn't mean that it's not your trauma that's affecting you, putting you through all this stuff. But we all think things are relative. Like, oh, I didn't have someone commit a murder-suicide in front of me, so I'm in good shape, you know? Leanne, can you share about what Family Initiatives is doing in our circuit and if you're doing it in other circuits as well?
Currently in Circuit 6, which is Pasco and Pinellas County, we provide in-home TBRI services to licensed caregivers. Basically, what that looks like is we have a master's level clinician come in. They do an assessment on what we call the target child, so the child that caregiver is identifying as maybe a little bit more challenging for their parenting skill. And we kind of do that assessment, kind of figure out what the target behaviors are that they're struggling with. And then we have family specialists who come back out after that clinician has done the assessment, guided by the clinician, and start implementing TBRI strategies and coaching through TBRI strategies real time in the home while the child's melting down, you know, coaching the parent on what to do. And then if there are no behaviors while we're there, which, you know, in most homes, there's always something happening. Then we ask them about like a time since our last visit where they've struggled with a behavior, right? And we role play that out with them, right? So tell me what you did. Okay, so this is what maybe I would try next time based on connecting or based on empowering, right? Like when they got in the car on the way home from school, did you offer them water or a snack, right? It's probably been 3 hours since they ate, maybe four. I mean, some kids are eating lunch at 10:30 in the morning at school these days. They're probably very hungry, and that's probably why they're cranky getting into your car, because their physiological needs aren't being met, right? And so like just kind of brainstorming ideas like that for them until we get them to a place where they feel confident to carry out these skills independently, and then we fade out. And so we do that here in Circuit 6. We also do it in Circuit 12, which is Sarasota, Manatee, and DeSoto. And we do it in Miami-Dade, which I believe is Circuit 11.
So if somebody is a caregiver in one of these circuits, they can reach out to you and the agency covers the fees?
Yeah, so we're contracted with each CBC. So there's no cost to the caregiver and we don't bill insurance. So it does give us the flexibility of being able to come in as frequently as we need to and to stay as long as we need to in order to get that parent to a place where they feel like they are able to do these strategies and interventions independent of us. I mean, really, there's two goals for this program. It's called the Family Impact Program. One is placement stabilization. So if a caregiver is identifying a child that they're struggling with, that child most likely is going to struggle if they get moved, and they're going to struggle if they get moved. And we know that each subsequent removal only creates more trauma for that child, right? So we want to stabilize that kiddo. And then the other one is to teach this caregiver skills that they can use for any other placement that comes into their home to keep the longevity of that foster parent. I think one thing that's happening in Florida is that we're seeing such a high turnover of foster parents, or lack of people coming in wanting to become foster parents to get licensed in the first place. Those are our two goals, is longevity of that caregiver and placement stabilization. One of the things that we're working alongside all of our partnered agencies is that when somebody is newly licensed, we call them. Right. And we say, hey, remember us? Because then we're also doing pre-service training with new foster parents. So that 9-hour training that you went through as an in-service for a currently licensed foster parent, we actually do that with people who are getting ready to become foster parents. So they get that full 9-hour training now. So they're getting TBRI right off the bat. And then we are calling them once they're licensed. Hey, remember, it's me. We did that lovely 9-hour training together. I'm sure you're sick of hearing my voice, but, you know, we're here. Don't forget that we're here. Let's talk about some proactive strategies, you know, while you're welcoming your first placement.
So the fact that they're doing that is actually really cool. I wasn't aware of that.
It's a new approach that we're trying to take across all the different circuits that we're in. In some of our circuits, if we can even be more proactive, we might go out and do a visit with the initial licensing specialist if we can get out there before they get a placement or the day that they do.
This is good, man.
That question of like, how could I change the system? It's integrating TBRI into all of these small little things, right? Because right off the bat, we're asking them like, so what have you struggled with just within the 24 hours? What do you anticipate is going to be a struggle just based on your 24 hours, right?
And sometimes like little tiny things can make a world of difference, like what you said about making sure their physiological needs are met. And sometimes we expect our kids to have the ability to regulate like an adult and they just can't. And then we're like, oh my gosh, of course it's food and water or something else.
Well, I find it funny because it's like not even all adults can regulate. That's where the whole hangry thing comes from, right? Like the quote hangry. Yeah. Like we don't even know as adults, like we push aside our physiological needs to kind of like bust through the workday, right? And then at 5 o'clock, we don't understand why we are so irritable. It's because we're living on caffeine and candy. Like literally, that's like when I look at my desk, I see Starbucks and candy wrappers.
I can't even tell you how many times I've heard Jack ask Jack Daddy, have you blank, blank, blank today? Or have you? And he'll be like, no.
out of that TVRI class that I took with you guys, two of the things that stick out the most are that chart thing. So I ordered these clear square things with spinners on them, and I made one for each of my kids.
The engine plate?
Engine plate, yeah. Yes. And then using like the sweet or the sour candy, which they love. The thing that I really took away the most from it, meeting the physiological needs, because if my kid's grumpy, I'm not like, oh, she needs a glass of water. Like, it's not your natural thing, because you're like, yeah. Well, she asked me for water all day long. Why doesn't she just ask me for water if she's thirsty? Because when you're in that moment, you're not recognizing that. So I'm telling you, I can't believe how many tantrums I have stopped with any number of my kids by they're upset about something. And I'm like, hey, let's get a glass of water. And the whole world changes.
Yeah. And that's helped me a lot too. And you taught me that from that class.
From that class. Yeah.
I was reading something that was talking about how like food is such a great way to show your teenagers that you love them and like bond with your teenagers. And that makes me happy. It makes me happy to make them happy. So I'm like, this is so good because it's like a hack. Yeah. Whereas with my 10-year-old, there's so many things we can do to connect. My 14-year-old wants to like take walks and go to Walmart and do things. But my 16-year-old doesn't really want to do anything. But the food thing, I was like, I can do the food thing. So I really try hard to like make food that they will like.
We actually had a caregiver in one of our sites who was having a terrible time connecting with a teenage boy. And she was a single foster mom. And so obviously very hard pairing right from the beginning. But she knew that he had a passion for cooking, and they come from very different cultural backgrounds. So she asked him to help her learn how to make the dishes that his mom made. And yeah. And awesome. So it helped kind of like bring some connection there, right? Now, he wasn't like running to her for hugs or anything after that, but he would talk to her in the car after school. He would come downstairs out of his room every once in a while for like 3 seconds, but still would come out of his room. Huge deal these days, right? And so it was, again, surrounded by food, being culturally aware and sensitive, right? So food is huge. Physiological needs are huge. And yeah. I just don't think that people give it enough credit.
In our very first season, one of our first episodes was with Chef Kimmy. He teaches foster parents how to connect with your kids through cooking.
Oh, that's awesome. You knew about TVRI before you knew about TVRI.
For anybody who wants to reach out to Family Initiatives, what is your website or how would they find you?
So it's www.FFlorida.org. And there is email that you can send basic information through.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you subscribe and follow us on social. We hope that you join us again next time and keep on fostering the future.